I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is playing defense. We're capping the show today with another story about a boxer, this one from a very different era. It's about a famous bout in 1938, one of the biggest of the period, that took place in what's now Seattle Center. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman brings us this classic underdog tale.
So, it's the 1930s, jobs are scarce, money is tight. Like a lot of teenagers, Al Hostack is trying to figure out how he's going to make a living. His dad worked with glass, so there was that. But there was also Al's passion, boxing. It wasn't exactly a sure sell, especially at this one particular moment, right before Al's first real fight, when he sees who he's up against.
Somebody called the Northwest Wood Chopper or something like that.
That's John Oakes. He's a boxing historian and author in Seattle who has talked with Al over the years.
He saw this guy, and he had a barrel chest, hair on his chest, and was not a particularly young man. He told his manager, Eddie, that guy's a man.
Al's manager says not to worry, just stick to what I've taught you. So Al laces up his gloves, gets into the ring, and next thing you know, bam, Al knocks the guy out. The match didn't go past the second round.
That was a big boost right there that, you know, he didn't really have to worry about the superficial thing about how old a guy looked or how brawny he was, that Al himself had something.
And man, did Al have something. One knockout became 10, 10 became 20. The wins kept stacking up until, before you knew it, Al was one of the best middleweight fighters in the country.
And now, here comes Al Hostack, that clean-cut, young, 23-year-old kid from Seattle, Washington.
It's no wonder people called Al the Savage Slav. He punched so hard that he'd sometimes break his own hands. And yet, he still had enough boyish charm for announcers to describe him like this.
Pink cheeks, nice, clean, young-looking boy, slim, husky, sort of waving his arms around.
But before Al was seen as any of those things, he was just a quiet kid from the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle. Here's John Oakes again.
He described it as a league of nations.
There were Slovaks, Poles, Germans. Al's own parents were Czech. He was the youngest of six siblings. And he looked up to one of his older brothers in particular. So when that brother started talking about Jack Dempsey, the world heavyweight champion at the time, it really stuck with Al.
And I guess he would shadow box and do all sorts of things, even though he'd never seen a fight, never seen Jack Dempsey fight. So that kind of laid the seed when he was about 5 years old.
You also don't have to talk much in boxing.
When he was a kid, he used to stammer and stutter.
Phil Hostack is Al's son. He says this stutter dogged Al throughout his childhood.
He was going to St. George's Catholic School there, and he was afraid that the nuns would call him to stand up in class and read a couple sentences out of a book. He couldn't do it.
Al didn't get any counseling back then, and the advice he'd often get was more or less just to get over it, which Oakes says probably didn't help.
Maybe his voice would quiver, maybe he'd shake, maybe he'd sweat, and that's really, an awfully uncomfortable experience.
So teaching or running for office or literally anything having to do with speech, as far as Al saw it, those types of jobs just weren't for him. Al was a doer, not a talker. So he gravitated towards things that didn't require a whole lot of explanation, like smacking around a ball at recess. Al felt at ease with sports, and it was just a matter of exposure when it came to boxing. One day, he and some friends were wandering around an alley, as kids were wont to do during the Depression, when they started messing around with a makeshift punching bag hanging from the roof of a barn.
And the neighbor came out of his door, and they all ran away, thinking that this neighbor was going to be mad at them. But he said, hey, wait, did you guys want to learn how to box? The kids, and this was during the summer, went back and started taking lessons. And by the end of the summer, Al was the only one that was going back.
Al gets to training, then fighting, mostly small local bouts. Al's son Phil says that after about 30 matches, people started to realize he was the real deal.
What do you think that was like for your dad? I mean, like, growing up with the stutter and not really being able to communicate, and then all of a sudden he found this thing that he was good at.
That gave him confidence. And when he started winning, then all the stuttering started to go away.
I want to say hello to all my friends in Seattle. I'm very happy I won.
This is Al being interviewed after a fight in 1939.
Tired, Al. You did a quick job. You must have been in a hurry.
I was in a hurry, all right.
The stutter seemed to disappear, although Al still dreaded public speaking, once going so far as to no-show for a scheduled interview. This fight, having difficulty speaking, it lasted well into Al's adult years, and it was way different from the fight that landed in his lap in 1938. By this time, Al was shaping up to be a serious contender for a world championship fight. His manager saw this, so did a local promoter. Al was ready, and it just so happened that the middleweight champion at the time lived 40 minutes away in Tacoma. So a date was set, 15 rounds against one of the most accomplished fighters of the time.
159, the middleweight champion of the world, Freddie Steele!
Freddie Steele was accomplished. He had confidence in his abilities, and many people would rank him as being in the top 10 of all middleweights.
Al and Steele ran in the same circle long before anyone thought to throw them in the ring. When he was younger, Al would scrounge together change to watch Steele fight. And as an amateur, Al fought on the undercard of Steele's matches, kind of like an opening act. So Al knew Steele's fighting style. He knew Steele would do this thing where he'd swipe away punches with his left hand, leaving his head unguarded for a fraction of a second. Along with his trainer, Al honed in on a way to exploit the habit.
And he'd been practicing it for years, and he only really had a split second in order to do this, because Steele was a smart fighter. So this had to be done just instantaneously.
It didn't just have to be fast. It had to be done under pressure. Everyone was watching Al. A stadium filled with gamblers, mobsters, and whoever managed to sneak past security. So the bell rings, the two walk to the center of the mat, and not even a minute goes by before Al gets his chance. Phil Hostack says his dad faked a punch, repositioned his weight, then threw a quick left hook at Steele's face.
That's how he knocked him down. Then gets up and he goes after him again.
And Al knocks Steele down again and again. And again.
And then the fourth time he got knocked down, he never got up.
Steele's manager slash mentor slash father figure died earlier that year. He was also reportedly getting over an injury. So maybe he wasn't at his best that night, but Al certainly was.
He had a flow to his movements and the speed, and everything came together. His mind and his body were one.
After Al wins, he gets a fat check for winning. And what does he go on to do? He didn't buy a fancy car, or a mansion, or a gold chain. He bought a gas station.
He would pump gas. He'd wash the windows. And, you know, he was a regular kind of guy.
In fact, Al's days as champion were brief. Injuries and the advent of World War II ended his career not long after it started. So when it comes to Al's legacy, the appeal isn't just about one short chapter on boxing. It has more to do with the ones bookending it, and the story you get when you put them together. It's the story of a guy who overcame his inner demons. The story of a quiet kid who became a well-respected figure in his community. And the story of someone who never stopped being just a guy from Georgetown.
That story from Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman.